From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Kuwaitis are celebrating the liberation of their country. During the seven-month Iraqi occupation of Kuwait, the newspaper The Voice of Kuwait kept exiles informed about what was happening to their country. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the editor, Dr. Muhammad Al-Rumahi, a Kuwaiti exile in London. Also today, the music of Kuwait, played for us by world music critic Milo Miles. And we talk with Israeli writer Yehuda Amakai about war, love, God, and poetry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The UN Security Council has tacitly rejected an Iraqi offer to comply with more Security Council resolutions in exchange for a ceasefire. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports from the UN.
Earlier today, Iraq's UN delegate Abdul Amir Al-Ambari delivered a letter to the council president. The letter said that if the council would declare a ceasefire in the Gulf War and nullify trade sanctions against Iraq, Baghdad would comply with resolutions ordering it to pay war reparations and to renounce its right to Kuwait. But allied officials rejected the letter, saying Iraq must comply unconditionally with all 12 resolutions. British Ambassador Sir David Hannay.
If I had to put it in one sentence, their interventions always appear to be too little, too late.
The council has asked Al-Ambari to return tonight to clarify his country's position. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The commander of Operation Desert Storm revealed today that Allied troops got to within 150 miles of Baghdad in their drive to cut off the Iraqi army's retreat from Kuwait. General Norman Schwarzkopf offered the observation as proof that the Allies never intended to conquer Iraq. In his words, there was nothing between us and Baghdad. Schwarzkopf told reporters that the Allied strategy was based on a ruse designed to make Iraq expect a major amphibious assault. The general said the second phase of the strategy was the last-minute shift of vast numbers of Allied troops from east to west, putting them in position for the drive into Iraq. A group of reporters reached the vicinity of the Kuwait International Airport after traveling 12 hours from Dahran, Saudi Arabia, with U.S. military escorts. NPR's Neil Conan filed this report, which was reviewed by military censors.
Despite the wreckage of many Iraqi tanks, self-propelled guns, and other equipment, reports of the scale of the damage in Kuwait seemed exaggerated until we were about half an hour across the border and saw the first oil fire. A refinery on the coast cast a huge plume of dense black smoke across the entire sky, and flames leapt up hundreds of feet. From then on, we saw fire after fire, each contributing a different shade of dinge to an already darkened sky. At sunset, there was a glow in the western sky from a series of fires whose smoke obscured the sun. The extent of the damage cannot be doubted, nor can the genuine jubilation of the people who poured out onto the highway to shout and wave flags and tell us their stories of brutality at the hands of the Iraqis and of their gratitude for deliverance. From Kuwait City, this is Neil Conan reporting.
Nine British soldiers were reported killed today in so-called friendly fire from a U.S. warplane. A British military spokesman in Saudi Arabia said that the men were killed when a U.S. Air Force A-10 tank buster mistakenly fired on two British armored vehicles during a battle. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 24 points today to close at 2,889. Advances led declines by 2-1. This is NPR. Job seekers are besieging the three Texas companies that have contracts to put out oil well fires in Kuwait. The companies say they're not hiring because the firefighting teams that will eventually go to Kuwait have been in readiness for months. The Red Adair company said that it's received about 4,000 calls from job applicants every day this week. Two other firms, Boots and Coots and Wild Well Control, say they're also getting thousands of requests. Company officials say that inquiries have come from all over the world and from applicants ranging from urban firefighters to laid-off construction workers. Leftist rebels in El Salvador have withdrawn to the countryside after a five-hour battle near the home of the president in San Salvador, the capital city. Tom Gibb filed this report for the BBC.
The rebels appear to have withdrawn back up the San Salvador volcano, which towers over the city. They occupied the wealthy area of Upper Escalon in force for the better part of the night. There was heavy street fighting. This is the same area the guerrillas took over repeatedly in 1989 as part of their largest offensive of the 11-year-old civil war. It's just a few blocks from the residency of the country's president, Alfredo Cristiani, although this does not seem to have been attacked directly. The fighting comes less than 2 weeks before National Assembly and local elections. It appears to be a show of strength by the guerrillas after United Nations peace talks again deadlocked earlier this month.
Tom Gibb reporting for the BBC. Realtors are blaming uncertainty about the Persian Gulf War for a 7% drop in home sales last month. The National Association of Realtors said that sales of existing homes fell by 7% in January. The association's president said that January is usually a slow month, and he noted that business was picking up by the end of it. He said that good news on the war front and favorable financing conditions were luring people out to shop for homes. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Kuwaitis at home and in exile are celebrating the liberation of their country. My guest, Dr. Muhammad Al-Ramahi, is the editor of a newspaper for exiled Kuwaitis called The Voice of Kuwait. It's been published since August 12th. The paper has offices in London, Cairo, Damascus, New York, Frankfurt, and three cities in Saudi Arabia. Before the invasion, Dr. Al-Ramahi had worked in Kuwait as an editor and writer with the magazine Al-Arabi, which he describes as a mix of the National Geographic and Reader's Digest. He left his country the day before it was invaded by Iraq to join his family, which was vacationing in Spain. He suspected there was going to be a war. His brothers and cousins remained in Kuwait, and he hasn't been in contact with them since the invasion. We phoned Dr. Al-Ramahi in London this morning and asked him what kinds of stories the Voice of Kuwait has been running.
Today, for instance, we have a long story came to us from Kuwait itself of what the Iraqis have been done to the buildings, various buildings, because, you know, the Kuwaitis, they know exactly what we are talking about. They destroyed the main public buildings, electricity, the telephone exchange, and what have you. And we described how they fled the country. They were, in fact, robbing our people. I mean, the houses empty or whatever, robbing them and putting things together, watches, pens, radios, cigarettes. And because they left in haste, they threw all those things behind them. The only thing they have used, which they have taken from the ordinary people, is the cars. So this is one a long story, of course. We have mentioned as well that the government of Kuwait is preparing to go back to Kuwait, various congratulation messages from the head of state, this kind of thing, because, of course, as well as the development of the battle itself, and what we think of Saddam Hussein.
What have you been able to learn about Iraqi torture and murder of Kuwaitis during the occupation?
We have been publishing those stories a long time ago, and unfortunately, some of the Western media have tried, looked at us in a very light way, and they thought we were exaggerating. And it appears that now we are getting names, specific places, and specific sort of tortures. You have to remember that since the invasion, our people have managed to come out of Kuwait either in late August, September, some of them in October, even some of them until December. So we know exactly what was going on, and we were publishing those stories from an eyewitness.
Can you tell us how you were able to get information out of Kuwait during the occupation?
We used various means and methods. As I told you, a good number of our people were coming out from Kuwait, and those we use either tape or written material without mentioning names or whatever, just, sort of suggestions. The Iraqis in the borders, they are just interested in the material things, if they have money, if they have passport, documents, if they do have jewelries, gold, they take it from them. We manage as well, and this is a story, this is the first time we are telling, to bribe our way out, if you like. A good number of Iraqi officers are corrupted officers, and they will do anything for you if you pay them the right amount of money. We used to have telephone satellites, very few of them, yes, but we managed to contact our people there. What we do is to send our messages through computer to a certain place in Saudi Arabia, and from there through the satellite telephone, and we get the messages back in a few hours' time.
Did you know who the people were when you were getting information, or is that something you didn't even want to know for the protection of those people?
We kept, at the beginning, we learned this hard, because at the beginning we were publishing things that should not be published. We were talking between each other. We shouldn't talk about it. Later on, we learned it because immediately when whatever we say, the Iraqis, I mean, whatever we say in the paper or in the media, the Iraqis will take it upon our people there.
What's an example of something that you published early on that you later regretted publishing?
We published something on the resistance, on the armed resistance movement, and we said that, you know, in certain quarter here or there, or, I mean, you know, we mentioned the exact place, and they have immediately went and besieged that place and searched for information. But people were very resilient, and you will hear a lot of heroic sort of stories. I mean, people write leaflets. They put them constant under their car batteries to hide them, move away, and then distribute them, this kind of thing.
How long do you plan on publishing The Voice of Kuwait?
I think we are here to stay. We have one of the lessons that we should have a mouthpiece, if you like, outside Kuwait. I don't think the information of the media battle has stopped there, because we have problems we have to solve later on.
Well, I'm wondering if you think the people of Kuwait want to go back to living in an emirate. And I should mention here that the Kuwaiti parliament was suspended in 1986, and the emir of Kuwait has declared martial law in Kuwait for the next 3 months. Is there a movement to have democratic reforms in Kuwait?
I think there is no sort of contradictions here. We have, as Kuwaitis, decided in our very famous meeting now in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in October, that we will reactivate our constitution of 1962. After a while, it depends on the circumstances, we will be having an election again. This is the facts, and I'm sure, I have no doubt of that a sort of parliamentarian democracy will be in exist in Kuwait very soon.
Is there a free press in Kuwait?
Yes, ma'am.
And I guess you think it'll take a while before the press in Kuwait can return to normal again.
Yes, of course, because basically the human being is there. Basically, the equipment, because the Iraqis have stripped the country from almost everything, from cars, equipment, computers, printing machines, even the operating theater and hospitals. So a lot of things will be waiting for a while until we re-equip our country.
My guest is Dr. Muhammad Al-Ramahi, the editor of The Voice of Kuwait. We recorded our conversation this morning. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Muhammad Al-Ramahi, editor of The Voice of Kuwait, a newspaper for exiled Kuwaitis that has been published since August 12th. I was reading a report today that said it was believed that the Iraqi soldiers took Kuwaiti hostages with them when they retreated from Kuwait City. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, ma'am. We had a report from Kuwait itself that a good number of our citizens have been taken by the Iraqis. They thought that probably will use them as the human shield while they are retreating. And it's unfortunate things, and I believe that Saddam Hussein and his government should be held responsible to that, because this is a very savage sort of practice. It's a medieval practice.
When do you plan on returning to Kuwait?
In a few hours' time.
In a few hours?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh. So, what kind of flight will you be taking back?
I'm leaving to Saudi Arabia soon, and from there, only a couple of hours driving.
So you're going to drive back?
Yes.
Is there a safe road to take?
Oh, yes, yes. It's free country now. You're welcome to come and visit us there.
No, but I mean, there's probably still a lot of landmines and blown-up roads and so
not
on.
Not the main roads, no. The main roads is our people have entered, I mean, just ordinary people have entered last night. Our engineer have entered today. As I told you, we distributed our paper in Kuwait this morning.
What's the first thing you plan on doing when you get back to Kuwait?
I'll kiss the land first of all, and then I'll kiss everybody I can get a grab of, and probably I'll go and see my families and neighbors.
Do you have any idea if your house is still standing?
Sorry?
Do you have any idea if your house is still standing?
I doubt it very much. I have no idea at all. I wouldn't say anything about it, but I do know that I'm writing against the Iraqis since the 12th of August, and my name is appearing every day. And I believe probably my houses has been blown up like a good number of houses and buildings in Kuwait. But what does it mean if you gain your country? It's nothing.
Do you think that putting out the newspaper, The Voice of Kuwait, put your family in jeopardy at all? Were you ever worried about that? And I wonder if you maybe even used a pseudonym while you were working at the newspaper to protect family at home.
You are right. I have been asked this question in one of the British broadcasting stations in mid-August or early September. My answer at that time was even my own safety, because people were frightened that Saddam Hussein, as we know, he has some gangsters here and there, and they can terrorize people. You see, my answer at that time, and still it is, was my life against my country. This is one. But if you write under a pen name, you will not have the same impact. I mean, you can write anything under a pen name and nobody knows who is he. I am a writer. I have been writing for the last 25 years in my life. I wrote books. I taught at the university. So people know me. And if I put my name, this make probably other people have the courage to do so and to start the movement against at least the resistance. Tomorrow, for instance, we are putting an ad in our paper, say like this in English. Of course, it is in Arabic, but at least I'll translate it to you as I can. The only chemical weapon we used is the ink.
Right.
So I think we have played a small role there.
So today was the first day that your newspaper, The Voice of Kuwait, was distributed in Kuwait.
Yes, ma'am.
How did you get it in?
We print in several places in Saudi Arabia, one of them in Dahran, which is not far away from Kuwait. It's a couple of hours driving. And we have a contingency plan long time ago to put it in a truck 2 o'clock in the morning and drive back to Kuwait.
So is that simple?
It is for us, yes. I told you we are very resilient people.
There are many Kuwaitis who will want to return as soon as they can to Kuwait. And I know that the Kuwaiti government is going to try to keep the return as orderly as possible. What role do you see your newspaper as playing in helping people who want to return to Kuwait as soon as they can?
We are appealing to our people in various places that we are going to issue a few numbers as soon as possible. Sorry. Again, we are appealing to our people through the newspaper that we are going to issue a few telephone numbers as soon as possible that they can contact their relatives and friends. This will probably take the pressure out from the anxiety people under now. There are families scattered here and there, and a wife, she was out, and her husband in, a father out, and his boy in. So this will make things easier later on. But I don't think it's advisable that everybody goes to Kuwait at this stage with no electricity, water, water supply. And of even there is no enough food for the population. So I think it will take a while, this kind of restriction. And later on, people can go back as easy as they can. Sir, our airport has been open this morning, as you know, for a very restricted planes. And hopefully things will get better very soon.
Well, I wish you a good trip home, and I hope that you find all of your friends and family when you get there.
Much
thank
obliged.
You very much.
May I use the opportunity to say thank you for everybody in the United States.
Dr. Mohammed Al-Ramahi is the editor of The Voice of Kuwait. He spoke to us from London. As Kuwaitis celebrate their country's liberation, world music critic Milo Miles samples some of the music they might be listening to.
For those unfamiliar with the music of the Arab world, the way in can be thorny indeed, even just in matters of technique. The vocals can sound harsh and nasal, twisting in incomprehensible patterns. The tonal decorations in the traditional rhythmic triads can escape or befuddle even the most attentive outsider. But I think there are two big challenges for anyone wanting to know more about the songs of the Arab Middle East. The first is strong concentration on the singer and his or her expressive prowess. If you don't speak Arabic, it's tough. You're pressed up against a dramatic recital you can't understand. The second big trouble is the apparent lack of what American pop fans would consider an arrangement. Unless you're used to following along, Arabic tunes seem to merely start and stop rather than begin, develop, and end. Oh, there's usually an instrumental introduction, and the way to overcome initial strangeness is to ride with the bouncy motifs or refrains played on certain instruments. The distinctive strains may come and go, but at least you'll feel grounded when they come back. We'll hear three Kuwaiti singers in this segment, the first two simply pleasant and enormously popular, the last one both very acclaimed and with a hit tune that laments the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. The song you just heard was by Nabil Shael, who is quite the worldly guy, up to the minute with synthesizers on every recording I've heard, though the one especially recommended is La Yasali. It's very hard to tell, but it seems to me Shael often goes for light-hearted themes, or at least there's a frequent chuckle in his voice. As with all Arab pop, part of the key to success with the Kuwaiti audience is how well Shael can blend old and new, make his songs sleekly high-tech and yet plenty Arabic. Shael does a dazzling job, particularly when he lets his rich, finely chiseled voice run loose. The next Kuwaiti singer is known simply as Rebab, and as with a lot of one-name performers, he's very much a pop star sex symbol. He's also very young, and his voice is a light, seductively androgynous alto that could make him a leading member of the New Kids on the Gulf. Unlike Shael, Rebab straightforwardly fuses with Western music. He grabs whole hunks of pop hooks and intonations and dumps them into his songs. Sure, it sounds a touch crass and obvious, but pop star sex symbols are supposed to be relatively crass and obvious. And you can tell Rebab's a dandy dreamboat. Rebab no doubt does a lot of numbers about the absence of a lover, since fractured romance is the grand theme of Arabic pop music as it is all around the world. A number that was a smash hit with expatriate Kuwaitis and their allies is by the veteran singer Abdullah Rashid. The song, which means there is no difference in the face of God, turns traditional modes of mourning for a lost love into grief for a country snatched away into darkness. It's very stark, plain, old-fashioned in tone, and full of timeless misery. So far, this is the song that best hints at the furious knot of agony and suffering that's been wrapped around Kuwait. And unless something sharper comes over the international airwaves, this will do for the world music theme of the war.
Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He says if you want to get a hold of Kuwaiti and other Middle Eastern music, his source is the Rashid Sales Company in Brooklyn, New York. They have an 800 number. It's 800-843-9401. That's 800-843-9401. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Israeli soldiers went off to war in 1973, some carried with them a book of poems by Yehuda Amichai. Amichai often writes about war. He's fought in all of Israel's wars with the exception of Lebanon. Coming up, Yehuda Amichai on what he learned from war. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Motoring with Muhammad by Eric Hansen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush will speak to the nation this evening concerning the Persian Gulf War. Mr. Bush will make his comments at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. A senior Pentagon official is quoted as saying that the ground war in the Persian Gulf War is mostly over. The official says that there are 18 viable battalions of Iraqi troops left, and only one division is still intact. The U.S. commander in the Persian Gulf, General Norman Schwarzkopf, says Allied forces have almost completely destroyed the offensive capability of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, and that Iraq will not be a threat to its neighbors as long as it's not rearmed. NPR's David Mopus has more.
U.S. military officials say the Republican Guards are trapped with no way out but to be destroyed or surrender. A massive tank battle is ongoing some 50 miles west of Basra. 700 Iraqi tanks knocked out in that fight already, which involves thousands of American tanks. The Allied forces swept down on the Iraqis from the west, hitting the Republican Guards and cutting off all avenues of escape. Of the 4,200 tanks in Iraq when the war started, all but 500 have now been destroyed or captured, according to U.S. officials. Two-thirds of Iraq's artillery guns in the war zone destroyed, and more than 50,000 Iraqis taken prisoner. The total number of U.S. personnel killed in combat since the war began, nearly 6 weeks ago, is now put at 79. The top U.S. commander calls that low level almost miraculous. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
A Palestinian leader has challenged the U.S. to seek an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip with the same determination it has given to Iraq's conquest of Kuwait. He insisted that the PLO has not been discredited because of its support for Saddam Hussein. Patricia Golan reports.
Faisal Husseini is the acknowledged leader of the Palestinian nationalist cause. Speaking today in his home in East Jerusalem, Husseini said Saddam Hussein had succeeded in putting the Israeli-Palestinian problem back on the world's agenda, even though the Iraqi leader has unlinked the withdrawal from Kuwait with Israel's withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza. Husseini had no apologies for the fact that the PLO and a majority of Palestinians backed Saddam Hussein.
I would like to tell this world, yes, you build a ship for Iraq, and we as a Palestinian were in the middle of the sea, and the only ship which tried to give hands for the Palestinians, it was the Iraqi ship.
Husseini said that only Saddam had championed the Palestinian cause. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Lloyd's of London has cut its insurance rates for sea and air cargo heading for many spots in the Middle East. The move indicates the company feels the Persian Gulf War may end in the near future. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 24.5 points to close at 2,889.11. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Ethics Committee says that it has found substantial evidence that California Senator Alan Cranston committed major ethical violations in his ties to former savings and loan owner Charles Keating. As for the other four members of the so-called Keating Five, the committee said that further action is not warranted. However, the panel said the conduct of Senators Donald Regal and Dennis DeConcini gave the appearance of being improper, and that Senators John Glenn and John McCain exercised poor judgment in their actions. The stage is now set for the Cranston case to go before the full Senate. Tens of thousands of people demonstrated today in the eastern part of Germany to protest a dramatic rise in unemployment there. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
In numerous cities, people took to the streets to demand an end to the growing unemployment in the former East Germany. About 25% of the workforce is either unemployed or working reduced shifts. Some economists predict that number could rise to 50% by the end of the year. In Erfurt, an estimated 50,000 people marched to protest the closing of numerous former state-owned enterprises, such as the Wartburg Automobile Factory. Tens of thousands also demonstrated in cities such as Leipzig, Halle, and Schwerin to press demands for a rise in living standards in the eastern half of the country to match those in the west. The Bonn government announced a rise in income taxes yesterday to help offset the rapidly spiraling costs of German unification. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
And for the first time in some 30 years, Soviet diplomats are stationed in Albania. Albania broke with the Soviet Union in 1961, but the two countries established diplomatic ties in August, when Albania's communist leader began making some political changes. However, last week, at least three people were killed in clashes in Albania with police. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Yehuda Amakai is one of Israel's best-known poets. Many of his poems are about war. His view of life has been shaped by war. He's fought in four of them, including Israel's War for Independence, the 1967 Six-Day War, and the 1973 Yom Kippur War. During World War II, he fought with the British Army in the Middle East. Amakai was born in Germany in 1924 and fled the Nazis with his family in 1936. They settled in Palestine. Amakai left his home in Jerusalem 5 days ago for an American book tour to do readings from his new book of poems, Even a Fist Was Once an Open Palm with Fingers. I asked him what it's been like in his family's sealed room during the Scud alerts.
At the beginning, it was really much more frightening until we got used to it. And so we went to this sealed room. And as I said, it's the first time that I have been in a war which I fought with cello tape.
Right.
It's very funny idea. But okay, we went there. I still have two children at home, a 12-year-old girl, an 18-year-old boy who's going soon into the army. So we went into the room, and the radio and television was constantly on. So it was a kind of contact we all had. People were talking. It's this kind of half talk show and with music in between. And when the alarm was, it was always very quiet and cool. And of course, a little girl was a little excited, and she's starting to be a young woman, so she's anyhow excited about life. So it's a bad start to be excited with a reason like that. And what
would you tell her?
Well, no, she's very bright and so on. She knows, but she tried not to show it. But I saw she was very tense and very. And the boy, of course, he was playing the big macho. He was taking charge because my wife and me, we sometimes thought, oh, come on, let's go on sleeping. If we are hit, we are hit. You know, it's that kind of attitude. So he never let us. He really took command of the whole house.
You have a poem I'd like you to read, and it's called What Did I Learn in the Wars?
Yes.
And it's in your new book, Even a Fist Was Once an Open Palm with Fingers.
Yes.
When did you write this poem?
About three years ago, I took my three children to the battlefields. I was in 48, which is in the Negev, in the southern part of Israel, which at that time was half desert. Now it's all, you won't recognize it's a desert anymore. And I showed them certain places where I hang out, where I took my friend when my friend fell, where I was wounded. And I took my children there. It was just a 1.5 hours ride from my home, so it's very near. And so it was really a strange memorial for me. So I took them there, and I have a few poems about that, which of a series which is called Anniversaries of Love. But it's one of the poems in which I summed it up. What did I learn in the wars? What did I learn in the wars to march in time? To swinging arms and legs, like pumps pumping an empty well, to march in a row and be alone in the middle, to dig into pillows, feather beds, the body of a beloved woman, and to yell Mama when she cannot hear, and to yell God when I don't believe in him. And even if I did believe in him, I wouldn't have told him about the war. As you don't tell a child about grown-ups' horrors. What else did I learn? I learned to reserve a path for retreat. In foreign lands, I rent a room in a hotel near the airport or railroad station, and even in wedding halls, always to watch the little door with the exit sign in red letters. A battle, too, begins like rhythmical drums for dancing, and ends with a retreat at dawn. Forbidden love and battle, the two of them sometimes end like this. But above all, I learned the wisdom of camouflage, not to stand out, not to be recognized, not to be apart from what's around me, even not from my beloved. Let them think I'm a bush or a lamp, a tree, a shadow of a tree, a doubt, a shadow of a doubt, a living hedge, a dead stone, a house, a corner of a house. If I were a prophet, I would have dimmed the glow of the vision and darkened my face with black paper and covered the magic with nets. And when my time comes, I shall don the camouflage garb of my end, the white of clouds and a lot of sky blue and stars that have no end.
That's Yehuda Amichai reading his poem, What Did I Learn in the Wars, which is published in his new book, Even a Fist Was Once an Open Palm with Fingers. Now, I want to ask you about a line in that poem.
Yes.
The line is, to yell God when I don't believe in him.
Yes.
You know, there's an old saying that there aren't any atheists in a foxhole.
Is there a saying like this?
Yeah, there is.
I
yeah.
feel like, as if I had said it. Yeah, it's exactly what I mean.
Yeah. Have you found in the wars that you fought in these conflicting feelings of not believing in God yet needing to believe in something faced with
it? I don't know if it's so much believing. I don't think it has to do with believing. It's just saying, it's just crying out something. So if someone says, you know, a lot of people who are believers and Orthodox, they always tell me, you see, if it comes to bad times, or even if you experience something very, very beautiful and good, you say, oh God, it was wonderful. So God is just a thing you say, because no one knows what it is and who it is. But it's something beyond. So I'm calling it. So instead of saying, oh, fate, or oh, supreme intelligence, and so on and so on, it's like I would. I called my father dad and my mother mommy, and it came to my mind to call my father dad. What's that? It's a name, it's a word. I never say, okay, it's a biological machine to produce me. Yes, so it's just a dad. So it's these things of childhood, and I think it's very great. It's a need to know that you can call something, even if you don't believe in it, and it's probably totally different, because otherwise, if the God imagined would be, it would be. Because Allah and God are the same, actually. Both Muslims and Jews and Christians believe in the same God. And yet each one prays to the same God to give victory to his arms. So it can't be, it must be something much more, which we'll never understand. And okay, because I'll never understand what it is, so why should I bother with it?
My guest is Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Poet Yehuda Amichai is my guest. Excuse me for the stereotype, but I know a lot of writers feel that they're more comfortable reading or writing, you know, at a desk than doing very physical things like fighting in a war. And I wonder if through all the wars that you fought in, you felt like a very kind of physical type of person, or if you felt uncomfortable in that role.
I didn't start my life as a poet. I started writing only after two wars, but I was sensitive to it, and words probably were welling up in me. But I never thought of, you know, when I was in the army. I don't feel I am a poet. It's totally meaningless. It's not a profession. You are a poet when you write a poem. The moment you don't write a poem, you are not a poet. And to give you an example about the last few weeks in all these air raid shelters and so-called sealed rooms, a lot of people, of course, ask me, "No, have you written a poem about it?" You know, they always ask you, "Something's happening. Oh, write a poem about it." But I don't. I forget that I'm a poet, and I think poets who are constantly aware It's in a very bad shape. People should be not aware constantly, I'm a poet, so what do I have to say? Yes.
In the introduction to one of your books, to a book of collected poems, the translator and editor, Hannah Block, tells about one of her friends describing how at the beginning of the 1973 war, the Yom Kippur War, her friends were going off to fight the war, and they were packing copies of your books of poems. And I wonder if you hear stories like that a lot.
Well, I've cried a lot because, you know, because my poems are out of experience. So whether it's a love poem or a poem about the death of my father or a poem about the war. So because I wrote only about my own experience, so other people can use it. And as a kind, I believe that every poem should always tell the truth, not say sweet things about situations we are not sweet, but on the other hand, not say everything is bad, everything is rotten, and death. And so I think every poem, I wrote it for myself as a kind of healing or a kind of soothing song to keep myself going. And then eventually other people in similar situations can use my poems as a healing or to go on.
Is there a poem of yours that you think became particularly popular among soldiers during certain wars?
Well, it's quite a lot, yes. I just can't mention one, but...
Well, mention one.
Yes, well...
As a matter of fact, you might want to read one of them. I have a book of collected poems here.
Yes,
I
think maybe one of the poems is called... it's actually the first, and it's one of the first I wrote about 4 or 5 years after the war in 48. And it says, God has pity on kindergarten children. God has pity on kindergarten children. He has less pity on school children. And on grown-ups, he has no pity at all. He leaves them alone. And sometimes they must crawl on all fours in the burning sand to reach the first aid station covered with blood. But perhaps he will watch over true lovers and have mercy on them and shelter them like a tree over the old man sleeping on a public bench. Perhaps we too will give them the last rare coins of compassion that mother handed down to us so that their happiness will protect us now and in other days. I think it's one of the... It's also a poem which... high school kids have to study.
Oh, right.
Yes, yes. So no, but the idea there is really that, first of all, about the merciless world, if you could, instead of God, you could say history or the world. The fact that the whole order of the world is not right, that we all think that helpless people need more help, more love, more compassion. So very small children... and bigger, but then the fact comes that an 18-year-old boy who is wounded in war and has to crawl on all fours like a crawling baby is more helpless than a small baby. So, and then, of course, the anti-war thing is love. Perhaps God will have some consideration for people who love. And for me, love is the only way to overcome the war. Also, love is much stronger, and not in the narrow sense of, let's say, like it's a Vietnam slogan, make love, not war, which is, life is like said, you have to have, like in this poem, you have to have a fist sometimes and sometimes an open hand. I would say, when you make love, don't forget that there are dangers in the world, which you have to do something about. And when you go to war, don't forget that love is the only force to help you.
And you feel you've always been able to keep that in mind?
Yes, I have.
Did you ever carry books of poems with you while you were in war?
No, actually not. But I read a lot before. And actually, there's another sad thing I found out in my last war. It was the Yom Kippur War. I was already 49 years old, so I was not in a first-line combat unit, but I could have been because things at that time looked very shaky. So I suddenly found out that in times of real danger, words don't help you. It's another big disappointment of my life. You know, when things get really very bad, I say sickness, so you go back to Mama and God. And right. And the same goes for good experiences. If you are really in love, you don't write love poetry. And if you, so you, you mean it, so nothing can express you. So that's a big disappointment.
And you feel like you didn't learn that until 1973?
yes, no, I try again and again. It always, you come to the same conclusion, but I keep on trying, yes, to say it better, to say it stronger and so on.
My guest has been Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. His new collection is Even a Fist Was Once an Open Palm with Fingers. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, earlier today, General Norman Schwarzkopf gave the most detailed briefing so far about the war strategy. What do you have on that?
Well, we're going to spend quite a lot of time on that, the best of General Schwarzkopf, with lots of tape of his description. We're also going to talk about why this approach seemed to have worked and why the Republican Guard does not seem to have been more of a problem than it has been. We're going to look at where we are now in this war. There are still some battles going on, and of course the Iraqis are attempting to move at the United Nations to stop it.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Eric Hansen spends his time traveling to faraway places and writing about it. His new book, Motoring with Muhammad, is about his experiences in Yemen. Book critic John Leonard says it has relevant observations about the country and its culture.
Late in this graceful and witty account of two seasons in the Middle East, after so many frustrations and surprises, Eric Hansen tells us, the point of my journey had shifted. When I first returned to Yemen, the country and the people merely provided an exotic backdrop for my search. But perhaps there was more sense in embracing new experiences than in wandering about in search of the old ones. After all, it wasn't exactly the Holy Grail I was looking for. If you're not sure where Yemen is, it's just south of Saudi Arabia. If you wonder what Hansen was looking for in his second trip in 1988, he sought the travel diaries he had left behind the first time, in 1976, after a shipwreck in the Red Sea, after synchronized dolphins and Eritrean goat smugglers, after being stuck on a desert island with 10 pelicans, and stuck for 10 days in a Yemeni prison as a suspected Soviet spy. He had buried these diaries of 7 years abroad on the beach in a Dacron sail bag. They included short stories, maps, recipes, love letters, language lists, and tips on how to subdue a camel by sitting on its head. Hansen went back for his writer's capital. What he sees is certainly exotic. The fabulous capital city of Sana, for instance, with the call to prayer from a white minaret, gingerbread fantasy and geometric squiggle, the sawtooth pattern and the zigzag frieze and the nippled domes of Ottoman mosques, a restaurant lunch like a rugby scrummage, and a bathhouse workout over slow fires fed by cow skulls, old rubber thongs, and worn-out truck tires. Sitting in the cafeteria of hope, waiting for a call that never comes from someone he refers to as the slave of God, he sees at dawn a white dove, a dervish, and a beggar in a wheelbarrow. Motoring with his driver, Mohammed, who'd rather shop for sheep than stop for sights, Hansen also sees Sabid, a 12th-century center for Quranic studies, and Yafras, the original home of the Kabbalah, and Barrakesh, where he is shot at in the 1,500-year-old calcite ruins. Besides seeing places, he meets people, at weddings and funerals, on fishing boats and in government offices, eccentric Orientalists, French jailbirds, security cops at the fingernail factory, paleontologists, Peace Corps volunteers, and little boys playing darts with discarded hypodermic syringes. He spends many an afternoon with medical students and a water pipe, chewing the green mush of the mildly narcotic Gat, and finds it to be a marvelous socializing experience, better than barroom drinking. He goes into the prisons to discover that Islamic justice is more sophisticated than the West thinks. he even comes to appreciate, and I quote again, the time-honored Yemeni tradition of taking hostages in order to bring attention to important grievances. And of course, the exotic is politicized. One reason it's so hard to get back to Hansen's offshore island is that the border areas, archaeological sites, oil fields, and tribal lands are strictly off-limits for security reasons. There may be training camps for the PLO on several of these islands. The Saudis sponsor a lot of border trouble. The Russians are said to offload military supplies somewhere near Salif. The goat smugglers are also smuggling assault rifles for civil war in Ethiopia. How these politics are subverted by the kindness of strangers, you'll have to discover for yourself by reading Hansen. But I'm reminded in his wonderful company how little I know about the Middle East that we're so busy bombing back into the Stone Age.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Motoring with Muhammad by Eric Hansen. Fresh Air was directed today by Roberta Shurrock. You know, James Brown just got out on parole, so we're going to close Fresh Air with some of his music. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, I feel good. I knew that I would not. I feel good. I knew that I would not. So good, so good. I got it. Oh, I feel nice. Sugar and spice. I feel nice, like sugar and spice. So nice, so nice, since I got you. When I hold you in my arms, I know I can't do no wrong now. When I hold you in my arms, my love can't do me no harm. And I feel nice. I feel nice. Sugar and spice. So nice, so nice that I got you here.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We hear a lot about the politics of oil in the Middle East. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the politics of water in desert countries. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.